We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Malcolm X was one of the most controversial Americans of the 20th century, perhaps also one of the most charismatic. A lot of what we know about him comes from the man himself, and he was constantly engaged throughout his life in rewriting his life story. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about a recently published biography that tries to take a fresh look at this complex figure. The book is Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention by historian Manning Marable. He was professor of history at Columbia University, and the life of Malcolm X was something of a major focus for him in his academic work. He spent something like 20 years exploring the life of Malcolm X and 10 writing this book. And sadly, Manning Marable died just before the book was to be published. We will, however, this morning be talking with an editor at Viking, the publisher of the book, that worked very closely with Manning Marable on the project, and our guest for the program this morning in this hour of Focus is Wendy Wolfe. She is executive editor at Viking and editorial director for nonfiction and has worked with a number of leading authors, including Nathaniel Philbrick, Jared Diamond, Elaine Pagels, Kevin Phillips. She's joining us this morning by telephone to talk about Manning Marable and to talk about the book, Malcolm X, and we're pleased that she could be spending some time with us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you're interested in being part of the conversation, all you have to do is pick up the telephone and call 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email, that's also possible if you'd like to participate that way. The address is will-talk, so that's will-talk@illinois.edu. And at any point here, if you're interested in being part of the conversation, you certainly are welcome to give us a call. And Ms. Wolfe, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, and I'm sorry you have to settle for me instead of Manning.
But well, I don't want to make it sound like we're settling. I certainly would have been very happy to talk with Professor Marable, and it's really sad. I'm sure that you felt the loss having worked closely with him.
Well, I worked closely with him. He devoted he put his every fiber of his being into the creation of this book, and it is his life's achievement. And he was so looking forward to engaging in the kind of dialogue about the book that the book has sparked and the book's publication has sparked, because it's raised so many issues about Malcolm and about America, and Manning was really ready to jump into that. So,
well, and certainly caused a fair amount of conversation and some controversy. I think some members of Malcolm's family have taken exception to some aspects of the book, and I think also as well some black academics have said that they have some issues with it. So I'm sure the conversation would have been – well, the conversation is lively, but it certainly would have been lively, and I'm sure he would have enjoyed having had the chance to be part of it.
The book itself is a remarkable creation, and it begins with the autobiography, and as all conversation about Malcolm does. Manning, 20, 25 years ago, read the autobiography and reacted to it as the powerful and transformative document that it is, and was very engaged with the ideas in the autobiography. But as he began to research the life of Malcolm, he began to see that there were discrepancies between the chronology of the autobiography, some of the events that are portrayed in it, and he began to be interested in that gap and where Malcolm's life, the actual facts of Malcolm's life, diverged from his and Alex Haley's presentation of that life. The more he found out about Malcolm, of course, the more interesting Malcolm becomes, and it was his goal, and I think he achieved it beautifully, to restore the true Malcolm, the actual man behind the myth, and as is always the case, the man is more interesting than the myth.
Yeah.
The man is more complicated, he is a more challenging figure, he is less, it's not as easy to hold on to him as an icon of a certain kind of behavior or a certain kind of politics. That doesn't in any way diminish how important he is to American history.
Yeah. I think that, perhaps people will be familiar with the basic story and the story that Malcolm tells in the autobiography that he wrote with the assistance of Alex Haley. The tragic loss of his parents when he was young, his knocking around Detroit, Washington, Harlem, his being involved in some criminal activity, his going to jail, and his maintaining that that for him was a very important turning point in his life. He said something to the effect that he didn't think anybody ever got more out of going to jail than he did. His involvement with the Nation of Islam, becoming a very important, persuasive, charismatic speaker for the nation, then the falling out with the leadership and eventually his assassination, allegedly by members of the Nation of Islam in the winter of 1965. Now, that that story is quite well known. That's a story that he was interested in telling in a certain way. And particularly for him, I think for Malcolm, he really wanted to emphasize the, let us say, the conversion aspects here. Maybe not so much religious conversion, but in a sense, a political conversion.
A political conversion. Though, ironically, the Nation of Islam was not a political organization. It believed in keeping itself separate from the white-dominated political institutions of America. So they were never pressing for the vote. They were never pressing for equal rights. They believed in self-sufficiency and separatism. There's no question that Malcolm had a conversion process in prison, but in order to highlight it, he had to make his life look more awful before. He had to make his criminality look more extreme. He was certainly involved in a series of petty crimes, and he was in the Roxbury prison for larceny and possession of an illegal weapon. He'd been involved in small-time drug dealing, some sort of marginal activities on the criminal scale, but not major racketeering. He was not a major mover and shaker in the black mafia. But he was a petty criminal. He goes to prison, and his brother, who has previously converted to the Nation of Islam, begins to interest him in the tenets of Elijah Muhammad's new organization. And he does come out of prison completely converted. He moves to Detroit, where he has family. He's raised mostly in Lansing, and a lot of his family's still in Detroit. So he moves from Boston back to Detroit and gets his first post as a minister, as an assistant minister in one of the temples in Detroit. That's where the ministry begins. That's where he begins to find his feet as a speaker and a recruiter and a promoter of the causes of the Nation of Islam, and to really begin to articulate the power and the potential of the African American urban community. And I think that's what Malcolm always has represented. He's represented an urban black image as opposed to an urban and probably lower class black image as opposed to the middle class, rural, up from the South, peaceful negotiation, the conciliatory movement that King and his followers, began to articulate in the 60s, mm-hmm. going into the later 60s.
And I think that perhaps helps to explain something of the clash between those two major segments of the civil rights movement. That is, they were coming from very different places geographically, in terms of social class, mm-hmm. In terms of what they thought was the appropriate kind of political action mm-hmm. to take. So
yeah.
their fundamental outlook right from the get-go was very different.
Yeah.
No surprise, perhaps, then that there would have been a conflict between those two streams.
Right. And the tragedy is that if you look at Malcolm's actual trajectory, the end of his life, where he has spent 7 of the last 9 months of his life in Africa, meeting with African leaders, becoming extremely interested in the new movement of Pan-Africanism, becoming again a convert to Orthodox Islam, which he discovers to be a much more humanistic, inclusive, expansive religion than he's ever been exposed to in the Nation of Islam, which is a very separatist, exclusive kind of religion. And he sees a world movement that he thinks African Americans can become part of. And he sees the expansion of the civil rights movement into a human rights movement. And this is a really exciting thing to think about where that might have taken him. You parallel that with King, who is beginning to make overtures to the anti-war movement, something that Malcolm did very early on in his political career. Malcolm is becoming more political. King is becoming more social. I don't think they were on a convergence path, but I think they were certainly on a parallel. They were beginning to be on a parallel track. They would have been a very powerful team working together had that opportunity ever existed.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Wendy Wolfe. She is an executive editor at Viking, and she worked as the editor with Manning Marable on this recently published biography of Malcolm X. The title of the book is Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Manning Marable was professor of history and public affairs at Columbia University for many years. He passed away just before the book was published. It's gotten a lot of attention. It's quite interesting. So if you'd like to read more about the life of Malcolm X, you can head out to the bookstore or the library and look for the book. And questions, comments on this show are certainly welcome, as always, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think that something that also Professor Marable thought was important and perhaps hadn't been emphasized as it should was the influence on Malcolm of his parents and their political views and their political involvement. And this was something that, the idea of black nationalism would have been something that he was really steeped in when he was young. It was not something that he first encounters later.
Absolutely. His parents are adherents to Marcus Garvey. They're Garveyites. And Marcus Garvey was one of the first people in the early part of the 20th century to start to posit the idea of black identity, black separatism, and black self-improvement and achievement. And he counseled, black Americans not to look to the white institutions for help, but to look to themselves, to look to their African roots, and to gather their own forces. His father and mother were both Garveyites. His father was probably murdered. He was run down in an automobile accident. It seems very clear, when Malcolm is 6 years old in Lansing, it seems very clear that this is a politically motivated act. So Malcolm, early on, is indoctrinated with the idea of both black nationalism and its potentially hazardous repercussions in white America. So Malcolm learns not to look to white America for anything, for nothing, for no help. He leaves school at 14. He's after his mother is unfortunately committed to an insane asylum. He comes to live with his sister in Boston, and he is in an all-black community in Boston. And this is when he begins to, lead a slightly more criminal life. He begins to go astray. Walks out of school the first day at age 15, never goes back again. But he never loses his intellectual thirst either, and by the end of his life, he's really become quite an intellectual.
The thing the storyline that people are going to be acquainted with is the story of his life that he tells in the autobiography. And this was, it was something that he wrote with Alex Haley. And this is a book that a lot of people have read. It's still in print, and there are still people reading it.
And it's still a fantastic document. I mean, it is one of the great self-proclaiming statements of the 20th century. But you have to remember that it was published after Malcolm died and that Alex Haley had a strong hand in the editing of it. And so you have to ask yourself, now, who is Alex Haley? Alex Haley is a liberal black Republican. He's a Nixonian Republican. He's committed to the idea of integration. He is an odd coupling with Malcolm, and I'm sure they had very interesting conversations that I wish I'd been a fly on the wall of. But he has an opportunity in Malcolm's life story to suggest that there was a coming second transformation, that after leaving the Nation of Islam and rejecting its exclusionary, self-contained goals, that Malcolm was striding towards embracing the King integrationist agenda. I don't think that the facts of Malcolm's life actually bear that out. And I think one of Manning's points is Malcolm was heading in another direction. So it's interesting to now read the autobiography with this in mind. Mm-hmm. And we want people to still read the autobiography. It is a work of literature, but it is not a work of verifiable fact.
Well, and I certainly think that, and I've seen some interviews that Professor Marble did a number of years ago talking about this, and mm-hmm. he seemed very clearly to be arguing that Alex Haley had an agenda here, mm-hmm. and that perhaps one aspect of the agenda, and you can see that in, maybe you see that in the autobiography, you see it in some other writing that he did, mm-hmm. was that he was interested in painting, not just in what he was writing about Malcolm X, but he was interested in painting a certain kind of picture of the Nation of Islam.
Yes. And, you know, I'm not as familiar with the other things that Alex Haley wrote, but I think he wanted to set up a very linear story, a kind mm-hmm. of black and white story. Nation of Islam, bad, you know.
Yeah.
King movement, good. Malcolm leaves, you know, rejects Nation of Islam, which he did. But he didn't reject it to go running into the arms of the middle-class civil rights movement. He saw the salvation for African Americans still within its own community, but he wanted to see the links that could be made with Africa. He wanted to see a kind of global outreach. He spends a lot of time in Africa. He's treated as a head of state when he's there. He convinces some of the African leaders to bring cases in the United Nations against America for the actions against African Americans. So he sees a globalization of the African American cause.
He, interestingly enough, and again, this is something that I think that Professor Marble was interested in and talked about a lot and said, and I think perhaps felt was very important in what it says about Malcolm in this period after he leaves the Nation of Islam and before his death, that he was involved in two major organizations, but two really different organizations. One was, it was a mosque, so this was a religious organization of African-American Orthodox Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand was a political organization that was much more secular. And you would think, well, that these two things must have been perhaps to some degree in tension with one another. How is it that particularly these two things, the Muslim Mosque Incorporated on the one hand and the Organization of Afro-American Unity on the other, those two organizations and his involvement in them, what does that say about him and where the direction that he was headed?
Yeah, sadly, when he died, both of those organizations were still in their embryonic state, so we have no idea what a kind of as fully formed institutions they might have achieved. But I think that they point out the two things that Malcolm felt were missing in the Nation of Islam. One was genuine religion. I mean, the religious practices of the nation were, he discovered to be quite an aberration once he found out what genuine Orthodox Muslim practice was. And so he tried to return to that kind of spiritual involvement. The Nation of Islam also played no political role. They did not advocate for equal rights. They did not advocate for voting rights. And Malcolm, very early on, while he's still in the nation, is giving a speech called The Ballot Versus the Bullet, and it is a call to African Americans that say, you must grab your rights. White America has to recognize Black America needs the vote. Black America has to recognize how important the vote is, or there will be violent consequences because of the nature of the oppression in America. So he understands, he's beginning to understand the power of politics. I don't see a collision between these two, and I don't think Manning did either. I think he believed that Malcolm was realizing the strength that was possible through these two strands of behavior, these two facets to the community. Malcolm was devoted to the African-American community. He thought it was a special, marvelous, powerful place full of potential. So these two aspects of his life, his religious life and his secular life, were going to enable him to capitalize and to bring African America into a much stronger position.
Hmm.
I can imagine the two working together eventually.
He was, Professor Marble, I think, talked a lot about, made note of the fact that so many people, particularly writers, but other kinds of creative artists, have drawn inspiration from Malcolm X, and certainly an awful lot has been written about him since his death. But I think his point, Professor Marvel's point, was that an awful lot of that was based on secondary sources, second,
right,
third-hand stuff.
Well, you know, the minute, the minute Malcolm dies, people begin grabbing at this image, you know, and taking it for what they wanted. They want Malcolm to mean to them, you know. And that's one of the reasons he has a lasting power. I think Manning was very, very interesting on the subject of how musicians gravitated towards Malcolm. People like John Coltrane, because of, I mean, almost because of the rhythms of his speech, you know, that he represented a kind of vitality in black culture that they could draw strength and inspiration from. And I think they were important in keeping Malcolm's name out there so that he just doesn't become a martyred hero. Can take it, you, once someone becomes an icon, however, the image takes on a life of its own.
Well, what do you feel were there particular things that that Professor Marble had access to and was able to use in the writing of the book that perhaps other people who have written about Malcolm couldn't draw on?
Well, he had the patience to wait it out, for one thing. He waited it out getting all the FBI tapes, waited it out getting as much as he could out of the New York City Police Department. I mean, ironically, it's a wonderful archive because FBI had Malcolm under surveillance for years. The New York Police Department tapped him for years. So we have a kind of paper trail of Malcolm's life. He had access finally through to Malcolm's travel diaries from his last trip to Africa. So we have fresh evidence from Malcolm's own voice of what he was experiencing and the documentation of that. Manning also had the time and the tenacity to track down all the people who've been involved in the Nation of Islam and his subsequent career. So we have hours and hours and hours of interviews, and he took the time to put the pieces together. A lot of people have written about Malcolm over the years, and they've taken a piece of him, a chunk of him. Maybe it's the assassination. Maybe it's the conversion. Maybe it's the second conversion. And try to nail that particular piece. And what Manning's goal was to assemble the entire package so that no aspect of Malcolm's life goes unremarked upon.
I think he said that that he felt his reaction to the autobiography was that he felt that there was something missing here. And in fact, or I guess at least people talk about missing chapters, things that had been sketched out that apparently for some reason Alex Haley decided to keep back and are somewhere. Mm-hmm. Various people say that they have pieces.
Various people
of this.
Have claimed to have them. I mean, I think they're, you know, if you go back now, knowing the contours of what his actual life is, and you read the autobiography, there's certainly gaps in it. You know, whether those gaps didn't suit Alex Haley's purposes, or whether they were just incomplete. You know, it was a work in progress. You know, and I, as an editor, I can certainly appreciate you. You know, you can't put in what God left out. You know, you can't write things that aren't there. So we can only hope that they surface, you know, and that they're authentic and that they're legitimate.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned at the beginning of the program that as an editor at Viking, you'd worked with a number of celebrated best-selling writers like Nathaniel Philbrick and Jared Diamond and Kevin Phillips and Elaine Pagels. And I've talked with a number of these people myself and know them to be very smart folks and have written really interesting books. And I guess one of the things that I wonder generally and then also specifically about your work with Professor Marble is that when you as an editor are working with somebody who is at that level, what is your role as editor? In what way are you able to help them perhaps write a better book than they would have been able to do on their own?
I think the most important quality that I bring to a project like this, and as you say, I'm dealing with people who are brilliant, who are much smarter than I am, who know a great deal more than I do about their subjects. I can bring perspective to it from the outside, and I can say, you now know too much. So let's figure out what's important. Let's figure out what to talk about. Let's figure out what to leave out. Because there are always decisions that have to be made. Even when you're simply writing a straightforward biography, you don't want to tell the story in real time. You want to know what do we foreground, what do we background. The other quality that I bring to it, I hope, is as their best reader, saying, have you told me enough about the background? Have you told me enough about the other events, the context around the subject? In the case of Malcolm X, I mean, there's a rich social history that's embedded in this book that talks about people like Marcus Garvey, that talks about the early days of the black community, talks about Harlem, you know, the Harlem Renaissance and the successors to that. We talk about, you know, the Detroit riots and the quality of urban life in New York. Talk about blacks during World War II. Malcolm is a young man in the early 40s, traveling on the railroads during the war. What was that like? So there is an opportunity to tell a bigger picture. And one of the things that I hope I'm able to do with my authors is give them some guidance when they have spent years and years immersed in a life or a story or a time and say, let's make some decisions about what's important to tell and what should be relegated to the notes or to just conversation or just to inform what winds up on the page.
Yeah. There have been some aspects of the book that have gotten a lot of attention regarding his personal life. And they're very small parts of the book, and I think that you even have said you're maybe a little surprised that those things get so much attention, but they are the kind of things that will get attention.
And I'm rarely surprised at what happens when a book is published, but I will say that I think I said, you know, Malcolm's sex life takes up about 4 pages of the book and about 400 pages of the reviews. Yeah. So.
Well, that perhaps, you know, gets to the question that one might ask an editor, why did you think and why did Manning Marable think that that was something that needed to be included?
Because I think Malcolm's personal life is part of the story. Mm. I think it's part of who he is. And if it makes people uncomfortable, that makes me sad because I think to censor or suppress information that is documented and that sheds light. We were not doing this in any kind of salacious way. He's not doing this in order to draw any kind of veil over Malcolm, cast any shadow on him. He's saying, look, Malcolm was a young man trying to make a life for himself in Boston. He was broke. He didn't have a job. He was doing the best he can. He had certain opportunities which drew him into this relationship with this rich white businessman that all of the testimony that we have that is believable says that he was involved in a brief sexual relationship with this man, as had other young black men been. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence that there was anything further to be said on that subject, and Manning says that very clearly.
Yeah.
But to leave that out, because Malcolm himself includes an incident like this in the autobiography, he simply ascribes it to someone.
Although
else.
He says it was somebody, this guy I know, had this relationship, was having sex for money with this rich white man, and
exactly.
It appears that in fact he may have known other men who did that, mm-hmm. but it appears that in fact he did that.
And he did that himself.
You know,
and it makes sense that he would try to put it off on somebody else, but it doesn't make sense to include it unless he has some intimate knowledge of it. But I fail to see where that diminishes Malcolm. You know, I just feel that telling the truth, I mean, I believe in sunlight. I believe that telling the truth, if it's done in a responsible way and for a reason, is always the best possible route.
In this hour, we're talking with Wendy Wolfe. She's an editor at Viking Books, was the editor on the recent biography, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. It was written by Manning Marable. He passed away just days before the book was published. The book is out now, and it's gotten a lot of attention. And we'll talk more about Malcolm X and Manning Marable after a short break. This is Focus.
The bike rodeo is coming to town. So round up your kids and bike them on down to the Urbana Market at the Square, Saturday, May 21st at 9 a.m. You and your kids will practice basic bike safety skills. Helmets are just $10 while they last. This free family event is brought to you by CU Safe Routes to Schools, CUMTD, and Illinois Public Media. For more information, visit wheelconnect.org/events.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. So we're here weekday mornings with 10 different topics. In the second hour today, we'll be looking for your questions about the state university's retirement system. And we'll have two guests, William Mabe, who is executive director of CSRS, and also Angie Lieb, who is director of member services. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest is Janie Scott. She's a journalist and biographer, and we will talk with her about a newly published biography of Barack Obama's mother. The title of the book is A Singular Woman. And then also tomorrow, Celeste Quinn will be hosting the 11 o'clock hour, talking with caregiver expert and author Cindy Laverty about her book, Caregiving, Elder Care Made Clear and Simple. We are here with, as I say, with 10 different topics every week. You can look at the schedule so you'll know what we'll be doing in the days ahead by going to our website. In fact, you can also listen to past programs, shows that you might have missed first time around. That's all on the website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour, we're talking with Wendy Wolf. She's executive editor at Viking, is editorial director for nonfiction there, and she was the editor on the recent book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, published by Viking, by Manning Marble. He was professor for many years of history at Columbia University. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have some callers here. We'll start with someone in Champaign County and line one. Hello.
On the last point, was this dalliance, if it did happen, was it strictly during the sort of hustler phase, or was there any political dimension to it that's commented on in the book? That's just sort of a short question, I guess, maybe. What it moved me to call was this business about the missing chapters. Well, Manning Marable believed there were three authentic missing chapters in possession of a lawyer in Detroit. He talks about this on an interview in Democracy Now!, at least in 2008, I guess, was the interview. It was from then. He believed that that was authentic. And he got to look at them, but not really spend any time with them and copy them. And it looks the fact that they're not available to be decided about is just very curious. And so I wanted you to comment on that. But the other thing is, everyone brings an agenda, and there are critics of Marable's book, which I haven't looked at. I've looked at some of his writings on the web. He's had been associated with a website called Black Commentator. There's a website, Black Agenda Report, which is pretty scathing and saying that basically one of their critiques is that Marable is trying to sort of make it look like the trajectory of Malcolm was to lead him to be sort of inclined to be a supporter of Obama in some way. And these people are very critical of Obama. So that's a little diffuse. But I just wanted to kind of get that out there. It needs to be examined.
Well, let's get some reaction. Mrs. Wolf?
Well, first of all, just to address the short question at the beginning, Manning makes very clear that the incident that takes place in Boston appears to be an isolated incident. It is during the period before he goes to prison. And as Manning says, there's no evidence of any further homosexual activity in his life. And that's all that can be said on that. In terms of the missing chapters, we don't have the missing chapters, and they're not available. And I don't actually know where they are. There are a number of documents of Malcolm's life that are in either private hands or are just not available. And it's a great tragedy. I think the archives should be in one place, and they should be accessible by everybody. And they should be we should be able to print and see them. It would answer a lot of questions, but we can't. If Manning saw them and was forbidden to copy them, then it wouldn't have been responsible to try to recreate them from memory. He was a scholar. He worked very, very carefully. There have been a lot of questions about, the what ifs of Malcolm, and I think I think what Manning most wanted people to understand was that Malcolm was on a trajectory towards, as I've said before, a kind of global view, an expansive and inclusive view of the human experience. It's anybody's guess who he would have voted for in 2008 if he were still alive. But I think the idea that a black man could become president is in and of itself an attractive one. Who cannot react positively to that image. I think the fight over Malcolm continues to this day, and the fight to claim Malcolm's legacy continues to this day. I don't think Manning took any claim to that legacy. He's just trying to put the facts out so that people can make informed decisions. But Malcolm is still obviously a touchstone in America, and you can, I think the interesting question is to ask, why does he still matter so much? Why is his, the voice people still want to hope was addressed to their cause? I think that's the best we can do at this point.
All right, let's go to Urbana for another caller. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. This is a fascinating show. I had two questions. I hope I can phrase them quickly here. I'm very interested in what you were saying about Alex Haley wanting to create a literary text, because in the afterword to the autobiography, the version of it that I read many years ago, he talks about the interview process that he used when he was working with Malcolm X to write this text. And there's a moment that stands out in my mind in that piece where he says that when Malcolm X had a serious argument with Elijah Muhammad and he was very disillusioned, he went back through the manuscript and he tried to take out everything positive he had ever said about Elijah Muhammad. And Haley says that he was trying to stop him from doing that because he said he was trying to preserve the drama of like a novelistic story. You know, this was my idol and now I don't like, but Malcolm was insistent. He didn't want to say anything positive about Elijah Muhammad. So I haven't had a chance to read the Manning Marable text yet, but does that ring true to what you remember?
That absolutely rings true, and I think it, as an editor, I can tell you, sometimes you have to restrain authors from rewriting their own history
in a
convenient way. I think
I don't
want to say that Alex Haley simply rewrote Malcolm's autobiography to suit his own needs. It's a much more complicated story than that.
Right.
Malcolm was rewriting his own history, and Manning shows, you know, for many years, Malcolm was Elijah's right-hand man. You know, mm-hmm. He believed in him. He believed in his cause. So to go back and rewrite that history is a kind of another self-invention, a retroactive self-invention.
Right, right, right. Yeah. And Haley was screaming about it, and finally Malcolm said, well, look, whose book is this anyway? You know, so,
exactly.
Well, the other question I had real quick was that when Alex Haley died, the thing that I remember was that all of his possessions were put up for auction because apparently his estate was bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody know whether or not the tapes that he used when he interviewed Malcolm, because you mentioned somebody has a manuscript from the book, some missing mm-hmm. chapters. Did anybody get those tapes?
Boy, I've never heard word that he got any word about the tapes.
Okay.
So you'd have to track the estate. See who bought the bits of the estate.
Right, right. Well,
wouldn't that be great to find?
Oh, absolutely. I have dreams, you know, one day going to a garage sale in Tennessee and just finding a cardboard box.
If you do, would you let me know?
Okay, great show. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
We have maybe about 10 minutes or so left in this hour of Focus. And again, the guest talking with us this morning is Wendy Wolfe. She's executive editor at Viking Books. She's an editorial director for nonfiction, and she worked as editor with Manning Marable on his book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. It's published by Viking and is out now. And again, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Another aspect of the book that certainly has gotten a lot of attention, not surprisingly, is that Manning Marable argued that the individuals that were charged with Malcolm's murder were in fact not guilty. I think he in fact argued that a couple of the people who were charged weren't even there.
Weren't even in the room.
Weren't even in the room, and that his allegation is that the law enforcement there, the police, and others were in on this, or at least they knew about it, and that in fact the people who were guilty of the murder are still alive and still at large.
There is very compelling evidence that that's exactly the scenario. What I would say, the way I would characterize it, and I think I've talked to Manning at some length about this, is there's a convergence of interest on the assassination. You've got the Nation of Islam, who's very eager, certain sectors of the nation, certain temples of the nation, very eager to get rid of this opposing force, you know, is building a rival organization. You've got the FBI, you've got a Hoover FBI who thinks, you know, this hothead, it would be so nice if he weren't here. It would be so nice if this voice were silenced because he's a danger. And you've got the New York City Police Department, who's been taping him for years, who thinks he's a obstructive force in the peace of the city. So the day that Malcolm is killed, normally there, you know, any number of police officers on duty at any of Malcolm's major events, and they're pulled off. Malcolm's own guards are pulled off. There's no weapons check on the way in. More precise, more sort of startlingly, within several hours of the assassination, the Audubon Ballroom is wiped clean. It's been spotlessly cleaned, stripped down. The chairs have been rearranged. There's going to be a party there tonight. It's not the way you would approach a major crime scene if, in fact, you want to document what actually happens. There's very swift rush to judgment. Three men are arrested. They're convicted. There's very little evidence. The two of them were actually in the room. But it's a convenient end, and it closes the case. And the New York City Police Department can say justice was served, and the world can feel better about you know, the attention paid to this case, when, in fact, from the very start, there were questions about how that case was conducted. And I think one of Manning's great goals in the book was to simply have the case reopened, have the New York City, have someone in the DA's office say, let's open the books. If the New York City Police Department has nothing to hide, then they should welcome this, I would think. So there are various institutions now which are interested in appealing and seeing if we can get this case reopened.
Well, there is no statute of limitations on murder, so it's always possible for someone to do that if they have the desire and the wherewithal, and the authorities are willing to cooperate.
Mm-hmm. And I think for someone like Manning, who is, you know, an impeccable scholar, I mean, you simply can't touch his scholarship. And he's a careful, you know, he's not a hothead, and he's not. I mean, he is an activist. Manning was devoted to the cause of social change and social justice, and which is, of course, what drew him to Malcolm in the first place and what kept him interested in Malcolm. Manning's own life is a wonderful parable of how you can affect social change both in your political activities and from within institutions. He has been the mentor to generations of young black graduate students and historians, and created path for young students that I hope will be one of his great legacies in addition to his work.
Yeah. Now, during the time that Malcolm X was involved with the Nation of Islam, there was a great growth in membership, and I'm sure that a lot of people would argue that he had something to do with that. Despite the fact that there are important departures in terms of what people believe between people who are involved in the Nation of Islam and people who are Orthodox Muslims, it is true that at the time of its peak membership, there really weren't a lot of Muslims in the United States.
No, they were really the only game in town.
Yeah.
And let's not forget, Malcolm was a mesmerizing speaker. Mm-hmm. He was electrifying, and he was their greatest weapon. He was a fabulous recruiter. I always say that one of the dumbest things Spike Lee ever did when he made his movie, which I admire, and I'm glad the movie was there, and I'm glad it put Malcolm's name back on the table again, but at the very end of the movie, over the credits, he runs actual footage of Malcolm, and suddenly you see this electrifying performance, and it obliterates all your memories of Denzel Washington, and you think, oh my God, let me go get footage of Malcolm. So you start looking at footage of Malcolm, and you say, if I had been in the room, I would have signed the pledge. You know, he had that kind of effect. So he was a really powerful weapon in the hands of the Nation, and he was the key to their recruitment policy. He traveled endlessly. He lived on airplanes for years of his life, probably much to his family's detriment. You know, there's no question that it was a strained family relationship because Malcolm was so obsessed with the work he was doing.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. Some people have argued that really, if you look at this and look at the history of the Nation of Islam, and again, you know, aside from doctrinal differences with Orthodox Islam, that what it says is that in fact Islam in the United is a much more American kind of phenomenon than many people think, and that this is and that the nation, you have to acknowledge the fact that the Nation of Islam is a big part of that.
Yes. I mean, I don't pretend to be an expert on either of them, and I don't want to, you know, speak more than I know, but you always have to look at the American experience there, and you always have to, and then you have to wonder, what would Malcolm have done now with his more complete understanding of Islam, and how would that have played out in this genuinely American context? It would have been fascinating to watch.
Maybe just we're coming down to the point where we have 3-4 minutes left. I can have you talk a little bit about the subtitle, A Life of Reinvention. That's obviously must be an important theme, or else it wouldn't be the subtitle.
It's the theme of Malcolm's life, and it was always the title. I was looking back at some notes I made when we signed the book up in 2005, and it was the subtitle then, and it never changed, because Malcolm reinvents himself 3 or 4 significant times when he leaves Lansing and he moves to Boston, takes up a certain kind of criminal life, when he goes to prison and he reinvents himself in the Nation of Islam, when he reinvents himself when he is exiting the Nation of Islam. He was unafraid to change, and I think that is a strength, not a weakness. I think that is a sign of courage and a sign of intellectual maturity, that as he matured and saw where he had gotten it wrong before, he was able to say, I was wrong, and now I'm going in another direction. This is not the act of a coward. This is the act of somebody immensely brave and who has a lot of self-knowledge. These are qualities that make us admire Malcolm, and I hope that they're the qualities that people who read this book will come to see are part of Malcolm's great strength.
Well, I think it certainly is part of his appeal, and also an aspect in which he is very American.
Yes.
Because that's one of the things that we as Americans really believe in, reinvention.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He is a great American hero.
Well, though, at the same time, he is a kind of a global figure. And maybe you can also talk about that and his interest in creating, helping to establish, foster a kind of global community that involved the whole African diaspora.
I think that his experience in Africa showed him that there was strength and that there was power in Africa that could be brought to bear on African American. That would not dilute the Americanism. I don't think he wanted the African American community to lose its special culture, which he so strongly related to lose its great, the rhythm of African-American life. But he saw it could be infused with power and resources from Africa, and that those connections would only strengthen the American aspect of the African-American community, not dilute it, not wash it out, not erase it. He didn't want to erase history. He wanted to embrace both the past and the future.
Just to add, so what do you think that Professor Marble really, if people took away only one or two key ideas, what is it you think that he would like them to know? And particularly, I guess, how would you think that he would argue that these would be things that maybe would be new or would be fresh insights?
I think he would say, and I thought about this a lot, I think he would say Malcolm is a greater hero than we ever imagined him to be, not because of his anger, but because of his courage, and because of his, and not because of his rhetoric, but because of his intellect, and that those are the qualities that were going to carry Malcolm forward, and that is the piece of the picture that we don't have, but not that we should admire Malcolm as you say, as a wholly American hero who had the capacity to inspire the powerless and to make them feel that they had worth and that they had opportunity and that they had community, that all of those qualities went into Malcolm's worldview.
And he, and again, I guess going back to this idea of reinvention, I suppose, as, again, as he told his own story, those were themes about himself that he chose to emphasize.
That he chose to emphasize. Possibly, you know, did he overemphasize them in an artful way? It's entirely possible. There is a truth in Malcolm X. There's a truth at the bottom of the autobiography, and there's a truth that suffuses the entire biography that are consonant with each other.
It must have been, for you, a remarkable experience. I mean, you talked a little bit about what it is your role as editor was, though, to be a part of this project that was so much a part of Manning Marable's life, for you to be involved in it.
It's been really one of the, for me, a transformative experience. And for the rest of the staff here, there are a number of us who worked very closely with Marable, both on the manuscript itself and on the preparations for publication and the opportunities that we thought we would have with Manning. And we all felt that we had contributed to something that was really a landmark in American history, not just in publishing, but in American history itself. And those are very rare in our business.
Yeah. And what was he like? Just to give us a memory of him.
Manning, as one of my colleagues said, he had a twinkle in his eye and a twinkle in his voice. He was always in a good mood. He'd always say, you'd say, Manning, we got to do this. We got to get this picture in. We got to fix this. We got to chop 200 words out of this copy. He'd say, we can do that, Wendy. We can do that. Now just tell me what you need to do. We can do that. He was ever optimistic. He, in the middle of the completion of the manuscript, he had a double lung transplant. Goes into surgery, comes out, has his recovery. The first thing he says when he comes out of the anesthesia is, now where's chapter 8? He kept his eye on the ball. And you always were glad to hear that it was Manning on the phone. And that I miss. I miss the sound of his voice. When I hear records of it, when I listen to tape of it, I still tear up because I just wish he were here for me to ask some of these questions to myself.
Well, for those listening who would like to read about the life of Malcolm X, you should look for the book that we've been talking about. The title of the book is Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. It's published by Viking, by Manning Marable. He was for many years professor at Columbia University, professor of history and public affairs. He passed away in April, just as this book was about to be published. And here in this hour of our show, we've been talking with Wendy Wolfe. She is executive editor at Viking, and she worked on the book with Manning Marable. And Ms. Wolfe, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you, David. It's been a great interview.